And a warm welcome back to the Business Bunker with me, Jules Serkin, and Gavin Serkin, my co-presenter. And Paul Andrews is on a little sabbatical, refreshing his batteries. And may I say, a well-earned rest, because he does everything. You know, he's Channel Radio owner, jobs in Kent, all those things. So I hope he's having a little, well, he's teetotal, so he won't be having a little snifter of anything, but he might be having a ginger beer or something. So we've just been hearing from really interesting guests today, and thank you for calling in, Nikiru Balamwu. She's been talking about AWB Africa and the trials and what she's doing to try and change work-wise and life-wise, really, for African women. So we're back in the studio. Let's have a natter about what we've been saying. Don't forget to tweet me, Jules Serkin, or G Serkin. Use the B-Bunk hashtag. But in the studio, we've got Ken Lloyd of Charisma Design and Francois Rainier of Acacia, both based here in Kent and France. And as I said, you'll guess which one by his name, Monsieur Ken Lloyd.
Monsieur Le Lloyd.
So, I mean, working with women, let's go back to Nikiru and just what she was saying. Have any of you had any experiences like this? It's probably hard for blokes, but Ken?
Yeah. One of the first clients I had in Lagos, actually, a long while ago now, was a woman. Ekio Andrew,
yeah,
lovely lady,
yeah.
And she started her own fashion label in Lagos. And she did very well, and she did some fantastically, as you say, colourful designs. And in fact, she sent me a couple of fabulous men's shirts.
And you're wearing them now?
Well, I'm not wearing it at the moment, though, but I've still got it. So when I lose some weight and fit into it again...
I wasn't going to say,
I'm not saying how long that will be. But yeah, fantastic experience. And another lady I had a lot to do with, Lydia Roa, in pharmaceuticals, she took the experience she gained there, and she set up on her own in Wines and Spirits, and is still running a very successful enterprise along those lines. Great business women.
Francois?
Yes, I mean, my experience, I mean, I mainly really know West Africa, but, you know, other West African women I've met in the UK and in West Africa tend to be very entrepreneurial. I've got several friends, you know, who started their own business while having young children and juggling a full-time job, and in some cases managed to make a huge success of it. So it is they've got lots of energy, and they really want to change things. And they tend to be as well very supportive of each other. I mean, the networks of African business women tend to be really strong. And I think we should really look up to them, because they are very driven, and they really want to make the world a better place for their children.
Yeah, because women typically are the sort of... children carers, not always, of course, there are house husbands, but certainly in my experience, at my ripe old age, I worked around having kids. And when I was working for ICI in my 20s, every time I went to a board meeting or was trying to travel, I'd get a call saying, you know, little Johnny is ill, can you come home? And it was me that went home, you know. That's just how it worked then. I think guys now are pushing pushchairs and taking more of a role in it. But certainly women tend to be naturally the carers, especially for young babies, and if they're breastfeeding and that, it's very, very hard. And I'm noticing that women in England definitely are putting off having children because they've got great careers and they're getting to 30, 33, 34. How do they leave that career? Very, very difficult for them.
One of the most remarkable places that I've been to in emerging markets and developing world is Vietnam, where you just go from company to company and you realize that you've seen a lot of female CEOs. And I was asking somebody about this, and they said, well, it dates back to the Vietnam War, where, you know, the men were at war
fighting,
you know, for years and years and years, and the women had to keep the home going, but also had to feed the kids. And, you know, so they became very entrepreneurial. This generation has grown up seeing their mothers in work, leading companies. And, you know, that's how I think gender equality really drives. You know, it's often where necessity steps in, and you think to an extent that, you know, us in the UK, gender equality had a lot to do with the economy as well, and women going into the workplace. If women are in the workplace, then, you know, yes, they are going to demand to have equal rights. And so it's a process that, you know, evolves in different countries.
I'm going to stick my neck out here and just, as a woman, say that the way that Theresa May was treated, and I don't want to be political, but I really don't think that she had the support that she would have had if she was a man. She went up on stage with, you know, really, really bad flu virus. She had a croaky voice. She was dying. She went on with it. And she got just so much abuse on Twitter, and they were laughing because she couldn't talk. Whereas if that had been a man, we'd have thought, what a trooper, you know, went up there and did it. A little bit the same with Hillary Clinton when she did her tour of presidency. You know, we know that she has a thyroid problem. Paul Andrews, if you're listening, you know I have a thyroid problem. It's a thyroid show. You know, if you have a thyroid disease, going on tour like that, as Hillary Clinton did, is brutal, that sort of schedule. And she, you know, she suffered for it and, again, was ridiculed. What do you think, guys?
Don't you think there's more of this sort of thing happening now, though? Manners going out the window. You see it everywhere. It's not just in politics, is it? And
I agree. Yeah. In fact, Ken and I have had a few discussions on manners, and I think when you're a certain age, so now guys,
wasn't a bad discussion of telling Ken off, was it?
No. I was saying about, you know, just manners. Where, so if you are working with a woman, you three in the studio. And those listening, do tweet in at Jules Serkin. Would you now hold a door open for a woman? Would you bring her chair back? What is happening in the workplace now, Ken? Ken's got his hand up.
Yes, I would.
Good. Yes, good for you, because I think I appreciate that.
I'd risk the rejection, you know, because it's the way my generation was brought up.
I agree.
It's just good manners.
I will mention that I carried all the bags up here to the studio today, up three flights of stairs, while Gavin sort of minced behind with his, you know, portfolio and his laptop. But we won't mention
it's
that.
A very heavy laptop I got.
He's a different
lots of data in it.
Was that Stephen Holden's data?
Oh, exactly.
Ken?
Yes, Gav, what you were saying about Vietnam, and I think that's general with wars, isn't it? I mean, going back to the First World War in this country, you know, it's well known that the women took over what the men were doing. They were bus conductors, train drivers, they were doing everything.
Yeah.
The sad thing was that when it was over, they had to go back to their old lives in general until things finally changed for the better.
Yeah, that's it.
I'm going to come in and ask Francois about, you know, you live in France, Paris, or...?
I'm from the south of France, but I live permanently in the UK now.
Okay. But I mean, is there a difference in France with, you know, French women I see as, you know, a cliche, chic, they eat baguettes and drink coffee and they stay slim somehow and croissant for breakfast. But is there a difference?
The help of Gaulle, I'll see
where it's. Difference in the way men behave towards women?
But anything that you want to bring in, you know, work-wise or manner-wise?
I would say... gallantry is universal, you know. I always hold door for women,
which is lovely.
You know, and I never got strange look for it so far. So it's usually well received. Sometimes I get a slightly surprised look because maybe they're not used to it. As well, you know, if a lady comes out of a car, we'll open the door for her, and I don't think it's politeness for me. Yeah, and I think in business relationship, you know, it's very important that what counts is your ability to do a job.
Yes.
Expertise.
Yes.
And nothing else should really matter, whether it is your gender or the color of your skin or any other characteristic. And I think, you know, we have some very successful women CEO now where we can look up to. I think the CEO of Pepsi, current CEO of Pepsi, is a lady. A name escapes me right now. So I think we're going to see more and more women CEO, especially I would think in new technology. And I've no doubt, you know, that possibly the new stage job is probably somewhere a young girl in Africa who's teaching herself to code. Right
yeah.
Now. Well, talking of young, you know, young girls in Africa, it starts with education. You know, it starts with, you know, so many kids in Africa. You know, that there's the way that childhood education is looked at favors the boys. You know, this is a huge generalization, but you know that this is where equality starts. You know, and it's making sure that girls are as equipped with, you know, knowing maths and knowing the sciences to get the engineering jobs and whatever is available, to make that entrepreneurial step, right through to the boardrooms and right through to governments. And Kira was saying about governments that have made that step to equalise the cabinet, but there's still a huge amount of companies out there that haven't taken that step.
I agree with you, Gav. When you see the children in African countries interviewed, they all are hungry for it. They're hungry for education, aren't they? They want to be teachers, doctors. They want to get on. And I think you might still have a point, though, that it still may favour the boys and not the girls. And that's a big challenge, isn't it, to deal with?
Yeah, I think education really is key, but as well, I would like to mention languages. I mean, for those of us who travel a bit for Africa.
Say that again, mention
the importance of languages.
Languages, you said it in such a French way.
Yes, because I was really surprised when you travel in Africa that, everybody speaks several languages.
Yeah.
They speak their own local language, they will speak French or sometimes English as well, sometimes they will speak Dutch.
Such skills.
And it's really... I think language are going to play a more and more important part now in international business because language is not about understanding what people say, it's about understanding what they think, their culture, and really be communicating with them and understanding them at a much deeper level. And I think I wish, that in Europe, in the UK and through the world, there'd be more emphasis on teaching language to young children and to teenagers. Because it is really key in ensuring a future in which people closely collaborate together and at a much deeper level, as I say. And in Africa, language is always very important. So, yes, I think language and education are a key part of raising the bar, really.
What I always find amazing is, when you're in countries like Nigeria, people will speak to each other in one language and then flip to another language. And I've said, how do you know to speak in that language? He said, I know the look of them or how they dress or how they are. And yeah, they've got all these languages buzzing about in their heads, which is pretty amazing.
Well, same when we travel with New Markets Media, we're always shocked. We go to Sweden, Denmark, everybody speaks English. Do we speak any Swedish or Danish? No.
Tack.
Yeah, tack. That's just from watching Valanda.
Skål.
Well, really. Doesn't get very far in the boardroom.
Heineken.
But I think England, and I was going to, I don't want to, sort of generalise, but when you see young Asian women, they're forging ahead, in England, especially some of the people we've interviewed, for top data jobs. Forging ahead the Asian women. So come on, English women, let's grab up on that and the language, especially as Francois said. We are now going to play a little bit of Kinks while we get our next guest and our last guest. It's going to be James Major, and he's coming on. He's responsible manager of responsible investing at Actis LLP. Stay tuned to the Business Bunker and we'll be back.
'Cause he gets up in the morning and he goes to work at night, and he comes back home at 5:30, gets the same train every time. 'Cause his world is built on punctuality, it never fails, and he's all so good, and he's all so fine, and he's all so healthy in his body and his mind. Well-respected man about town, doing the best thing so conservatively. And his mother goes to meetings while his father pulls a maid, and she stirs a tea with counsellors while discussing foreign trade. And she passes looks as well as bills at every suave young man. And he's all so good, and he's all so fine, and he's all so healthy in his body and his mind. He's a well-respected man about town, doing the best thing so conservatively. And he likes his own backyard, and he likes his bags the best, 'cause he's better than the rest, and his iron sweat smells
was the Kinks and Fading Them Out, because we have the next guest on, James Mager, who is the manager of Responsible Investing at Actis LLP. You can find them on the Twitter, Actis LLP, and they're a leading investor in growth markets across Africa, Asia and Latin America, LATAM. And you can find them on www.act.is. Hello, James, are you there?
Yeah, hi, good afternoon.
Hello, well, you sound the most echoey, and we've had Lagos and New Zealand, so I hope you're comfortable, and it's a real... Yes, my producer's sorting you out, that's lovely, he's turned you down. But it's a real pleasure to have you on the show. And we've been discussing, James, beforehand, themes on Africa and gender equality with the campaign group, which is called African Women on Board, AWBE. And I wondered if you could tell us how gender focus fits with Actis's overall approach, please.
Yes, of course, no problem. So there's two areas where it fits into our approach. First and foremost, we ensure that any discrimination on the grounds of either gender, ethnicity, sexuality is prohibited across all of our investee companies. Mm-hmm. And secondly, and probably more interestingly, we have a working group focused on inclusion and diversity within Actis, which is promoting the positive aspects of diverse teams and diverse boards, because we have a view that diversity gives you a greater range of talent. It mitigates against groupthink. It makes our companies ultimately more effective, more successful, and more profitable.
Okay. And are you getting enthusiasm for this approach, or are you meeting barriers?
No, we meet generally with great enthusiasm. I think people welcome the opportunity to work with more diverse teams.
And James, tell us, how can investors and businesses actually assess their own impact on society and indeed the world?
So if we broaden it out into, yes, the positive impacts on society and the environment, I think the starting point is to consider, when you make an investment, what are the core revenue-generating activities of the enterprise or the company or the project? And identify how that benefits society or the environment. I think instinctively people recognize that healthcare, education, renewable power is contributing to society in a positive way. The challenge we find is actually measuring that contribution in a more systematic, rigorous, objective way. So we've been working with the Impact Management Project, which has established the fundamentals of positive impact, and try to apply a scoring system that we've developed called the Actis Impact Score.
So take us through that a bit, James, because, if we think about impact on society and impact on the environment, most people would feel that that's a good thing, but it's very hard to put into numbers in the way that you just said. We would think anecdotally about how a company is making electric cars or doing what they're doing in an environmentally friendly way, or employing some people that maybe don't have too many opportunities. How do you put that sort of stuff into numbers?
Yeah, so we start with the IMP, the Impact Management Project, and their fundamentals or dimensions of impact. So we really think of every positive impact in terms of what, how much, and who. So what is the impact that we're having? How deep is the impact that is experienced by the beneficiary? Who is the beneficiary? How well-served or underserved are they for that particular service? And how many people are you reaching? So that means that investments that have a really deep, profound, positive impact on a large number of people that are underserved for a particular service, whether it's healthcare, education, or clean energy, will score a much higher impact score relative to other investments.
So how do you go about that? Because, if you think about, something like how many people are impacted, some things will be really have a very strong impact, but maybe it doesn't affect quite as many people. I'm just trying to work out how you would put that into a context where you could actually say, okay, this project looks pretty good because it's having a fairly strong impact, let's say, on education compared to another project which maybe is having a strong effect on health of people, you know, against another project maybe that's, you know, helping the environment. How you know, when they're as disparate as that and maybe in different geographies in the world, how do you put those on a scale that's measurable?
Yeah, and I think you're right, Gavin. The key is to put it on a scale that's measurable. To the extent that's possible, identify the measurable aspects of that impact and apply a scoring system which allows you to directly compare investments in different sectors, in different geographies. If we take employment, for example, that's an area of positive impact and development impact that is one of the easier ones to quantify. You know, we often invest in parts of the world that have significant challenges with unemployment. But if we are providing high-quality, skilled jobs to a large number of people, the value on someone's livelihood of an income and a reliable job is quite significant. So just taking employment as one metric, that's easy to compare across different investments. If it's, for example, the examples you gave around education and healthcare, they're more difficult to quantify. But if you think that the healthcare service that you're providing is perhaps a life-saving medical treatment, and you're trying to compare that with the benefits of tertiary education, you can plot that on a scale, as we do, between 1 and 5, and use international benchmarks to try and establish how profound the impact is on people's lives. And then we look at how many people and their access to education or healthcare services. And this allows us to develop an impact score.
Okay. So Actis, you know, at Actis you're an impact investor, which means that, you know, everything you do is focused on making money, but also on creating a social and environmental benefit. But you're also a commercial company, so Actis is competing against lots of other fund managers out there. How do, you know, the temptation, I guess, would be to say that all of your investments are doing wonderful things. You know, how do you convince people out there that you know, your numbers are going to be credible?
Yeah, well, as you said, Gavin, we have a fiduciary duty to our investors to deliver competitive returns through our investments. So we don't compromise on that. But at the same time, we believe that, you know, enterprises that we invest in, companies and projects that positively contribute to society, are more sustainable businesses. They're more resilient. They have greater longevity. They're less susceptible to short-lived fads. And ultimately, they are more valuable companies. So we have a slogan called Values Drive Value. We believe that this focus on positive impact actually enhances our returns rather than diminishing them. But in terms of how we verify that, we have our Actis Impact Score, and we make sure that those numbers are auditable by an independent third party. And we've also committed to complete transparency around our methodology for measuring impact.
James, are we allowed to mention who the third party is that measures the audit? Or not?
You don't have to. No, okay. Not at the moment.
I don't blame you.
But it's interesting because, you know, it's creating, I guess, you know, if you think about the growth of the impact investment industry, I think it's been, you know, one of the fastest asset classes in the world. You know, it's doubled to $500 billion pretty much last year, you know, which is about some funds suddenly calling themselves impact investors that maybe weren't in the past labelling themselves as such. But still, you know, it is certainly an area that increasingly investors are putting money towards, you know, whether it's family offices or pension funds, councils, local governments. So it's kind of driving an industry that does need these credible third parties, you know, almost like the auditors that we need to make sure a company's profits that they're stating really are the profits.
Yeah, absolutely. And on the third-party audit point, you know, this initiative to systematically measure the impact we're having is something we've launched this year. So we're currently in discussions with various auditors to perform our verification audit. But yeah, Gavin, you're absolutely right. I think this shift towards impact investing is based in part on a societal shift. The millennial generation is profoundly influencing our society in many ways, and including the preference to invest in alignment with their personal values. And this has led to a significant increase in capital being directed towards strategies that invest in a positive way. But the lack of transparency across the industry around measurement of impact, it's often black box, opaque, or it's a selection of metrics selected by the manager which give the best impression. But, you know, we believe that impact washing, it probably poses the greatest threat to the impact industry and in terms of undermining confidence of the people that want to put their money to work in a positive way. So, you know, verification, transparency around measurement systems, these are really critical building blocks in building confidence in the impact investing sector.
Right, because I mean, I hear what you're saying. They're, you know, if one bad apple, I suppose, you know, is seen to rot the cart, it's, you know, all these families that did want to do the right thing, and I think it's more than about personal values. It's also about, you know, the inheritance that you're leaving to your children. You want that to be financial, but you also want it to be imprinted with your own values that you want to pass on to your family. And you know, I've spoken to, you know, various different family offices that do think in that way, and that's why they are putting money into impact investment. But looking at the challenge of what you're creating the solution to there with the Actis Impact Score, you know, Actis has its own way of going about it. If we talk to other impact investors, they'd have another approach. And so if you are that family office, you know, first of all, yes, it's got to be independently audited, but you're also going to have a lot of different ways of measuring things thrown back at you. And how, you know, how, which one do you choose? You know, how can you compare, you know, the way that you're approaching measuring impact against, you know, let's say another investment manager?
Yeah, I think what we're seeing, whilst impact is still a very nascent industry, we're seeing the emergence of core principles that around which all investors claiming to have positive impact should be aligning. So the International Finance Corporation,
which is part of the World Bank,
which is part of the World Bank, have launched their operating principles for impact management, and Actis was one of the first signatories alongside 60 others that have adopted these principles. And alongside IFC, we think the Impact Management Project fundamentals and dimensions of impact are very complementary to the IFC operating principles. So we're seeing the emergence of consensus, and the consensus is really around stating your intention at the start of an investment, making it clear that you intend to have a positive impact and what you intend to do. Then measurement, which is where the IMP dimensions are particularly relevant, and then around verification of your results. So I think if you are, you know, transparent about your intentions, you have a measurement system that's robust and credible, and you're verifying your results, those are the things you should look for in any investor, and that's what Actis is seeking to promote. Now, our measurement system is one option. There isn't a huge amount of choice out there, as you mentioned, but increasingly we're asking the industry to promote greater transparency around measurement to allow the the asset owners and the investors and the pension holders to make a more informed decision about where they place their money.
Right, because one thing about the way that you've gone about this at Actis is to make it open source, to be very transparent about, you know, your portfolio of companies and, you know, how you're measuring them, how you're attributing numbers. But as you said earlier, you know, a lot of the providers are a bit more black box about it. So, you know, how do you see this moving forward? Do you think that other companies will also want to display their measurement in a more open, transparent way?
I think, one, we hope that, you know, the asset owners will call for greater transparency. I think that will drive the industry. But I think from our perspective, our motivation of making this open source was not because we necessarily thought, we've cracked it, or we have the perfect measurement system, but simply by making it open source, we can let others comment. We've had some terrific and very constructive feedback from other investors on our system. We have investors in our funds that now understand that when we talk about an impact score to them, they understand how it's derived and they can better understand our results and interrogate them. And we've also had some really positive interest from other investors, including competitors, who would like to understand more about our system with a view to potentially adopting it for their own impact measurement. I think in terms of giving confidence in the impact measurement or the impact investing industry, all of this has to be a positive thing. And by inspiring confidence, the industry will simply become stronger. So that's our objective.
That's really interesting that you've got competitors particularly looking at your system, because if you think about, you draw a parallel to how we look at financial information. You know, there's pretty much one way now of measuring net profit. You don't get, you know, 20 different ways to. You used to, you know, when I'm old enough to started in financial journalism, where you did, you know, look at a company, whether it's following US GAAP standards or other accounting standards from other parts of the world. But, you know, accounting standards are pretty much unified in international markets. But, you know, if we could drive towards the same goal as that in the impact investing world, you know, where everyone's looking at similar kind, like you said, the principles are the same as laid out by the World Bank's IFC, then that I guess is real progress.
Yeah, I think greater consistency is the objective. I'm not sure we'll ever get to a single measurement system, a one-size-fits-all, but I think what we're seeing is a convergence around core principles and much greater consistency around measurement.
James, if people want to apply maybe the way that you've looked at the social impact of investments, the environmental impact, lay out how they would go about it. If it's a company listening in maybe that, you know, feels like they are impactful, how do they go about doing what you're doing of translating that into numbers that maybe ultimately also has a financial benefit in making the company more investable?
Well, a good starting point is the Actis website. Under the Responsible Investment section, we have a white paper that we've produced that will take interested parties through our scoring system step by step. It includes some case studies looking at renewable power in India, education in Brazil, healthcare in Africa, and that will give a good understanding. We've also got a short explainer video as well, which will help people to understand our scoring system. So that's a good place to start, and I'd also encourage people to look at the Impact Management Project, because this is another organisation that is producing a lot of really high-quality material about impact. And their website is excellent as well. And then GIIN, the Global Impact Investing Network, have recently released their Iris Plus system, which is a collection of useful impact metrics for different sectors. So I would say immediately those are three good resources.
That's brilliant, James. We're off now, but it's been really interesting talking to you, fascinating, and we're going to continue the discussion in the studio. But for now, you can find Actis on 3wsact.is And a big thanks to you, James Magill, for coming on, Manager of Responsible Investing at Actis LLP. For now, goodbye, and we'll speak to you very soon.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
So that was James Magill of Actis, Responsible Investing at Actis LLP. And so, guys, back to the studio. We're back in the studio now on the Business Bunker Show with Ken Lloyd, Charisma, and also Francois Renier and Gavin Serkin. Gav, you know, for the man on the street that's listening into, man or woman on the street listening to the Business Bunker, investing, okay, we all know that our pensions, I was talking to a beautiful cabinet maker in Whitstable recently, when I bought a blanket chest. You can see the story on my Twitter, Jules Serkin, bought a blanket chest from what I thought was an English company, Cotswold company, and it came and it absolutely reeked of varnish, and it was obviously not made in England and probably from China. So I sent it back. I couldn't, after 3 months, get rid of the smell. And I found a local cabinet maker who matched the price, did it with water-based paint. It's beautiful. It smells of pine, as it should. And a big thank you. And if anybody wants to know his details, let me know. But why am I talking about this? He told me that he had invested, as the government told him to, in his pension. He's now 66, from the day he started work. And he said, I've got about 12 grand to live on when I retire. So tell us, bring us in on, you know, man on the street, man, woman on the street, what can we do?
Well, I think he probably should have invested in the Chinese manufacturer of cupboards that would have made a bit more money. I mean, it's difficult, isn't it? Because when you look at the state pension, yes, it's, you know, it's going to be the amount that we need to live on. And, you know, if it's why the government really does encourage people to think about what they're going to need for their retirement and invest appropriately for that, and, you know, put some money aside. And, you know, it's all very easy to say when you're young and you're trying to afford a house and you're trying to, you know, keep the family together and pay for schools and all the rest of it. It's very hard.
I kind of wonder about people, you know, the big rental market now, people are renting rather than maybe being able to put down that deposit. So when they retire, how are they going to find a grand a month to pay the rent? Anyway, guys, back to you two. So Ken and Francois, what are your thoughts on the show so far and what we've been talking about? Ken. Ken put his hand up first, Francois.
Or a pen up. Even.
Yeah.
I thought it was very interesting listening to James. And being as I am not an expert in investment, as you know.
But you are. You did retire, but we keep making you do work.
I know. But seriously, you know, the importance of impact, gender, sustainability, transparency, and the way it's gained momentum very, very quickly and is continuing to gain momentum, I think, is really interesting. It's almost becoming, is it becoming an internationally accepted language, a standard language, which, you know, is everybody's beginning to catch on to and to use.
Yeah, I mean, it's really, if you impact along with ESG, environmental, social, governance, you know, those are the, I suppose, the phrases that an increasing amount of funds do attach to what they do.
Yeah, it's got
to
be good, isn't it?
I think so. You know, it's moving the right direction. But, yeah, you know, I think, as James said, you know, the really dangerous thing is that everyone buys into this into this idea that this is what investment should be about, because we all want to invest responsibly. And then you realise that actually the people that you maybe giving your money to, partly because you thought they were doing such a wonderful thing for the planet or for society,
yeah,
actually aren't. And that, you know, if a crisis happens like that, and I use the crisis word because, you know, because it would bring down a lot of different funds that are investing along those lines, and that's why the industry does really need to
transparency,
bring transparency to the fore.
Francois,
Yes, I think it was a fantastic program because we talk about different subjects. We talk about, you know, investing, additional business.
We've traveled the whole globe.
Yes, we traveled
in 2 hours.
But the big picture really is that I think everything is even more connected than before, and it's getting to a more and more connection, and making connection to global level through language, through education, through having common standard for sustainability, and all this is going to be vital to growth and to, thriving, all of us thriving. We all want to have a thriving community, thriving cities, thriving businesses.
And am I right? And your wife's from Ghana, am I right? Or am I just guessing
yes,
that?
Yes. And I had the chance to travel quite a lot for my career. And when you travel a bit through the world, you realize that everybody wants the same thing. Everybody wants to have a successful business and successful communities. Mm. But I think parenthesis of this program really, I think, was really useful to see that, you know, equality between gender in the workplace is still as good as we would like it to be, and that having common standard for sustainability and assessing investment and, you know, things like this is really, really important. So I think we're moving towards a common language across all areas, isn't it? I mean, that's my perspective on it.
Well, I think that is true, and I think, you know, if you look at the news, you know, about you know, whenever you turn on the news now, it seems to be one country up against another, either in terms of physical military strength. You know, we've seen increasing tensions in Asia, for example, India going into Kashmir.
Iran,
exactly, and. You know, there's got to be another force that fills that vacuum, you know, because people don't want that kind of tension.
I think there's another Business Bunker show coming on when Mr. Andrews goes off on another holiday. Let's get him off. So you've been listening to me, Jules Serkin, on the Business Bunker show. It's a show that supports and loves to support startups, SMEs throughout the globe. And my thanks to my co-presenter, Frontier author Gavin Serkin, Mr. Ken Lloyd, Francois Renier of Acacia, in France and in Kent, and our telephone guests calling in from across the globe, from Lagos, Nikiru Balonwu of African Women on Board at AWB Africa, Actis Manager for Responsible Investing, James McGaw, and Copley FR, Stephen Holden, calling in from New Zealand. He's the CEO and founder. And our super sponsors, I'm In My Zone, the lovely Paul Andrews. We'll be back with you next week. Keep your tweets coming in. Use the hashtag BeBunker. Tweet us at VanillaWeb, at Jules Serkin, at G Serkin. And my lovely producer, of course, thanks to Craig Avery. Goodbye from us all here in Kent, in Ashford, and across the globe. From now, it's goodbye from the Business Bunker.
The Business Bunker with Paul Andrews.